Perkins until the end. This year, he was booked for over 20 shows, and just last Saturday, he was spotted at a gig in downtown Austin. Sammy Yenigan, NPR News.
Rising oil prices are translating into higher airfares as airlines try to offset higher jet fuel costs. Rick Sini is with the group FareCompare.com. He says the higher fares are coming just when travel demand is ramping up for the spring and summer seasons.
In the recession, there was plenty of discounted seats, but nobody had any money to pay for them. Now we have no empty middle seats at all, and the prices are much higher. So it's sort of flipped over the last 2 years.
Sini says the best time to shop for cheap airfares is Tuesdays at about 3 p.m. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Citrix, providing mobile access to an Office Mac or PC using GoToMyPC for iPad. Learn more at GoToMyPC.com.
You'll find thousands of used albums, plus CDs, videotapes, DVDs, and working stereo equipment at the 2011 Vintage Vinyl Sale, held on April 30th. We'll be at the new site, the former Altman's Billiard and Barstool Supply, located at 301 West Market View Drive in Champaign. Proceeds benefit the Illinois Radio Reader.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming Russia's oldest symphonic group, St. Petersburg Philharmonic Orchestra, for an evening of Brahms, Rimsky-Korsakov, and Shostakovich on Thursday, March 31st at 7:30 p.m. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Today, both shows come from the archives. They're programs that we broadcast in January of this year. So do keep in mind as you listen that you will not be able to call in this morning.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we are very glad to have you with us. Almost 1,000 years ago, the place we now call Cahokia in southwestern Illinois was the site of the largest prehistoric Native American city north of Mexico. And at the center, covering 6 square miles, there was a pyramid. It rose to 100 feet. It was, until 1867, the tallest structure in the United States. Yet by 1400, this place that very quickly grew into a thriving metropolis, it completely disappeared. The people left. And some very interesting questions are raised about who built Cahokia, why it is that it grew so rapidly, what contributed to that rapid growth, and also what contributed to the rapid decline. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Tim Pocketat. He's a professor of anthropology here at the University of Illinois, and he's done a lot of work at Cahokia and, in fact, has written a book about it. And if you'd like to read about Cahokia, the title of the book is Cahokia, Ancient America's Great City on the Mississippi. It's part of the Penguin Library of American Indian History. So Penguin Press is the publisher, and it's in paper. And it's a very interesting story. And if you have never been to Cahokia, you might want to take a look at the book, and then after that, you'll probably want to go and see it, and certainly you should. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, well, thank you.
I appreciate it. Maybe I'll start this way. If you go to Cahokia today and you walk around the site, tell us just a little bit about what it is that you will see there now.
Well, if you go today, you really only see the central part of this city, and it's the more public part that was preserved by the state in the late 20s. And then it's been added to since. So you'll see the central pyramid, which is the third largest in the New World, and you'll see a series of the other pyramids around the central plaza, which is a huge flat area, for public ceremonies. And then you'll see some peripheral kind of features, a wood henge, some other kind of low-lying mounds, all sort of surrounded by highways and older subdivisions. So in fact, there was a subdivision right in the middle of the plaza up through the 80s when it was finally removed by the state. So you'll see kind of an eroded, sad-looking vestige of what the city actually had been, which was more sprawling and not covered with, mowed grass 1,000 years ago.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to the preservation or lack of preservation a part of this maybe in a second. But so having then set the scene a little bit with what you'll see today, suppose that we could go back and we could go to Cahokia or whatever the people called it at its peak, what would we have seen?
Well, you would have seen First, just to walk into the place, you would have had to kind of walk through a mile or so just to get, you know, into the core of what I just described that you see today. And in passing through that mile or so of area, you'd cross small plazas, you'd go by smaller pyramids, and on top of these pyramids, which would have been dark earth-colored, sometimes even approaching black, you would have had larger temples, pole and thatch structures on top that looked something like a contemporary house in Mesoamerica today. Some of these would have been quite large, and then surrounding them would have been neighborhoods. Smaller pole and thatch houses. At its peak, there would have probably been about 10,000 people living there, which is sizable for an early city anywhere in the world. So you'd be passing through a lot of people, a lot of activity. There would be certain areas, the plazas in particular, or the around the mounds, you would not have been able to walk. That is, people wouldn't have just been left to wander aimlessly. There are rules about what you could do in certain parts of the site, the sacred spots, especially in that core area. Mm-hmm. So it'd been very clean, very organized. The alignments of buildings would have been sited to major astronomical events. You would have sensed that if you had walked through this space, that it was not just, you know, haphazard arrangements, uncontrolled. There's very much an order that was in place there. Hmm.
And within the boundaries of what we now call the United States at the time, would there be anything else like this?
No, there was nothing like this at the time. The only thing comparable, and it's much smaller, is out in the Southwest in the area of Chaco Canyon. And I'm sure some listeners have been there. And that is, it's a population of Chaco Canyon was only a couple thousand people, but really elaborate monumental buildings that they were constructing there for primarily religious and political purposes. And that was about the same time. In the Eastern Woodlands, it really, things followed Cahokia. Cahokia sort of kicks off a period called the Mississippian period. And when it kicks it off, you have people in other parts of the South and Midwest who look to Cahokia as an archetype and they copy it. So you get smaller Cahokia-like towns springing up all over, all the way down to Florida. But that follows. I mean, that's, you know, after 1100, 1200 or so. Hmm.
One of the things that that strikes me as I read about Cahokia today is that here we have this place. It is a World Heritage Site.
It's a World Heritage Site.
It has a lot of significant and interesting things to tell us about life of indigenous ancient peoples here in North America. And it seems that not only here in Illinois and within, you know, a couple of hours distance of Cahokia, not only are not really sure why it's important, it seems that there are a lot of people that don't even know that it's there.
Right.
And how is it that in our midst here, we have a World Heritage Site that is so poorly known?
There's probably two or three reasons that I could just off the top of my head, you know, are obvious to me. One is, it's a state park, and it's not a national monument. And so people kind of drive by it and don't think much about it. If it were a national monument, which, you know, some of us are trying to push it toward being, it would have more recognition in our country. Two, there's still this remnants of feelings by most European Americans, African Americans as well, that's sort of whatever happened before Columbus doesn't matter so much. So there's not an emphasis in schools as much in ways as should be on teaching American Indian history, pre-Columbian history. Things happened that mattered. I think that's a legacy that we still, you know, we're living with. It's getting better, but that's part of it. I think the third thing is simply it's surrounded by urban blight, it's run down subdivisions, things that were built right after World War II in a hurry, old factories. It's a somewhat polluted area. It's not a particularly pretty area, and so people, it doesn't attract them like, say, a Chaco Canyon or any kind of southwestern Pueblo ruins attract people, because you can still go there and see it, and it's remote, it looks pretty. You don't see that in the Midwest so much.
Yeah. Well, and maybe when my next question would be to make the point or offer you the opportunity to make the point that it's seemed to have been a long battle to try to preserve
the site, and as recently as a few decades ago, really, people were still fighting about, battling over it, trying to
still preserve. Still fighting now. I mean, yeah. People try to get the whoever they can to buy bits and pieces of what's left, and significant chunks are still sitting out there, waiting to be carved up by the next development. Like the site of East St. Louis, which is actually a suburb of Cahokia. It's an extension of it. We've recently learned that it's intact, and there's archaeologists now from the University of Illinois who are excavating a part of it to make way for a new bridge that's going to cross the Mississippi. What's left of it, we all worry, is going to be grabbed up and developed before anything can be done to stop it. So, yeah, there's a lot there. It's sort of hidden. Because there's so much urban development, and we need to buy more of it.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Tim Pocketat. He's professor of anthropology here at University of Illinois, and we're talking about Cahokia. It's a place that he's done a lot of archaeological work. He's also written a book on it. It's titled Cahokia, Ancient America's Great City on the Mississippi. It's published by the Penguin Press. If you'd like to read about it and to question, certainly are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe there's some people listening who have visited and they'd like to
I hope so.
Talk about it. You can give us a call. When European Americans were passing through, and they saw what remained, what was there, did they understand that these big mounds, particularly the biggest one, were something that humans had made?
It's a good question. It's really interesting because the first observers, the first Europeans who actually Cahokia was kind of lost in the wilderness right across from St. Louis for quite a few years. It wasn't until 1811 that we get the first written account by a European American who happens to have been a friend of Thomas Jefferson. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of this enlightened frontiersman. Henry Marie Brackenridge was his name. He walked into it. He knew what it was. I mean, he was blown away. It was still very well preserved, and he could see the order that I was talking about earlier, and proclaimed it was an ancient city and linked it to American Indians. Well, it wasn't long. 1830s come around, and you have the attempts by Andrew Jackson and his politicos to kind of move Indians west. At that point, you get this mound builder myth grows in popularity, which is basically denying native people a claim to the mounds because that makes it easier to move them west. And so from the 1830s through the beginning of the 20th century, really, you've got a lot of people denying, prominent scientists who don't want to believe that American Indians could have done this, north of the Mexico border anyway. And that's the legacy I was talking about earlier that, you know, we're still kind of living with, and people still use the word mound builders more generically, but it harkens back to this older kind of racist notion that, you know, not Indians, anybody but Indians.
In fact, people had some really goofy sort of ideas. Oh. They made these stories up about who, if this was not the indigenous people, if it was not American Indians, then they had to make up some story that would account for how it is that these things got there.
We have everybody from the Egyptians, the Israelites, to the Mormons, to Aztecs, you know, somebody from Mexico who are, of course, also indigenous people, but somehow that was better or easier for European Americans to accept at that time.
Well, and it seemed that the received image that we have of indigenous people are people who lived in small groups. They moved around a lot. Essentially, they were hunter-gatherers. They put up small temporary encampments where they lived, but that we haven't so that doesn't – this idea that there could have been this massive city with all of this infrastructure built, all these people living there, that idea that just doesn't fit with what we've really been told all this time.
Right. And in fact, the more we know, the more we realize that the fact that Cahokia happened when it did really sets up history and the kinds of people and the locations of Native people that the Europeans met – is a function of the fact that Cahokia existed and then it broke up. And so what some of the people mistakenly believed was a state of some hunter-gatherers or some low-level horticulturalists existing in the way they always had was in fact false. I mean, it's in fact a deterioration or the breakup of the Cahokia. Had they come just a few centuries earlier, they would have had a totally different impression and maybe would also have a difficult time moving west with a city sitting there.
We have a caller here, someone listening in Indiana, so let us talk with them on our toll-free line. This is line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
When you started talking, you expressed fact about the astronomical points. And I was wondering if you could talk about that in any particular way. I first thought about, well, I wonder how this got handed down from where to where, if you happen to know that. Then I started thinking, well, hell, maybe they did it themselves, you know. So I wonder if you could speak about that. And secondly, you mentioned sort of in a defensive way that things happened here that were important. Wish you could give one or two of them so some of us who know very little about that period of American history, whether Europeans or Indians, could have some kind of, guidance there to look at it later, you know, in the library and stuff like that. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Let me take the last one first, and I will address it a little bit, and I'll be more specific with the first part of that question. When Cahokia appeared, pretty immediately, they seem to have sent out missions small colonies into the interior of Illinois, into Wisconsin, south into Missouri, Tennessee. And I now think that they're actually actively spreading a kind of a religion, or at least a specific kind of view of the world. We're excavating in Wisconsin right now, and that's what we're finding. And things change right at that moment that you get Cahokian contact with them. So that is, local cultures are changing. And the many native identities, tribal identities, really are a result of that kind of contact, Cahokia developing and then their contact with other people. So they represent a kind of a hinge point in Native American history. So that's why I'm saying things happen that really matter to understanding, the course of events in North America. When I say they're spreading a religion, what we're seeing in Wisconsin and what I'm kind of going back to Cahokia and looking back through things, what you see is really it's a religion, like all religions, based on astronomy. I mean, they're watching the stars and watching the night sky and the day sky, so you see a heavy emphasis on siting their buildings or orienting their buildings and a wood henge and their mounds to reference primarily the sun, which is an easy thing to observe throughout the year. You know, the sun rises and sets up and down along the horizon, and there you get the solstices, and they clearly recognize the solstices, and those are major events in their year. So they're primarily referencing the sun. There's also a series of sites sort of set out in the prairie, Illinois prairie to the east, that are aligned to these more obscure events of the moon, things that are called standstills, which happen once every 18.6 years. We think that people had this knowledge of the moon and the sun and also the stars going way back in the east into what's called the Hopewell period or the Middle Woodland period around the time of Christ, especially in Ohio itself, where the Ohio Hopewell is. They seem to be referencing the same thing. And it's a difficult thing to figure out, especially the cycles of the moon, which astronomers didn't in the U.S. and Europe didn't really going to rediscover it until the early 20th century, that there's this long-term cycle. They also knew about it in the Southwest, so at Chaco Canyon, which is contemporary of Cahokia. So they're watching all the major things. They are clearly concerned with positioning themselves relative to what happens in the sky, given the way they're orienting the mounds and their buildings. And presumably, they figured out something. They figured out their own. They have an astronomy that is the root of their religion, and they seem to be attracting people because they have it. They understand the heavens, and that's attractive. And so, Cahokia sort of blossoms really rapidly. In part, I think, because it's a new religion, and they people pour in to experience it, to visit these various kind of lunar and solar sites. And then some stay, some go back home. It's a big pilgrimage center. It becomes a city in really short order in the middle of the 11th century.
So that's one of the tantalizing questions about the place is that how is it that what had been apparently an area where there were a number of smaller agricultural villages, what happened that led to this very rapid period of growth where there was all of this building and this very significant influx of population.
Let me see if I can address that, but continuing with my earlier thoughts. That is, the gentleman also asked, like, well, how did they remember or how did they pass this along? And what we see just before Cahokia, the local people don't seem to have this knowledge. Mm-hmm. You can't locate it archaeologically with alignments and whatnot. And then Cahokia has it. And so the question is, well, how did they get it? And they had priests, certainly, and there may have been certain priests who actually who remembered it from the olden days, from way back in Ohio, that kind of moved to Cahokia and you know, become part of that whole movement. So that's certainly there are religious specialists, there are priests who may be retaining and passing along this very esoteric kind of knowledge. But there's still some kind of crystallization moment. And what happens to cause it to all come together all of a sudden, and we don't know for sure. In the book, I sort of speculate it could be the supernova event, which dates to 1054, which is about when we think Cahokia, the city, was built. And it could be that, you know, this event, which produces a star in the daytime sky for a couple of months, would have worried people and been a cause for them to kind of congregate and to have some religious person tell them, here's the answer. Here's what we need to do. You know, maybe we need to build Cahokia. And then that sort of becomes a snowball and just keeps rolling.
Our guest, we're getting close to our midpoint here. Our guest, let me just introduce again, is Timothy Pocketat. He's a professor of anthropology at University of Illinois, has done a lot of work in Cahokia, archaeological work, has written a book. If you'd like to read more, you might take a look at his book, which is Cahokia, Ancient America's Great City on the Mississippi. It's published by Penguin. And we have some callers, and we have a number of them. And again, folks will help us by being brief. That way we can get in as many as we can. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's someone else here in Champaign County where we are in line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I had some specifics. I have visited the site and there were some things that it's a great display, but I have some questions that were raised when I was walking around in it. But on this idea of the colonists always suggesting that there was nobody really there, that's an idea that rings down to contemporary times. I don't know how long you've been on campus, but Susanna Hecht, whose early book on, and it's now being acknowledged that, you know, the Brazilian rainforest was not a uninhabited impenetrable jungle. I mean, she had a very early book called Fate of the Forest that was real heretical in its time. Footnote is that it was co-written with Alexander Coburn, a political analyst. But so I think there are a lot of implications to that, but I'll leave that hanging in the air. And then there were two things that I thought weren't sort of the dietary insights you can have. I'm particularly always been preoccupied with amaranth because it's a high-protein grain that isn't grown much. There's the idea from, I think I learned it from anthropology, that it was forbidden by the Catholic Church and through Latin America as a not appropriate food for newly converted people. But I think it figured in that region, in the Mississippian region. And the other thing was water transport. There's some murals in the museum that depict people on small boats. But it seems to me with as much as of the land work and the raising of the structures that they built in the way of mounds and stuff, that I can't imagine that they didn't also construct lots of canals. And in the spring in the Midwest, the lore was that you could go from, you know, across Illinois very easily on a boat. And I'm just wondering if anthropological studies figured out somehow how important that was and how it fit into their lives. Okay. And I'll hang up and listen. I know that's a lot, but
it is a lot.
Well, let's see what we can do with that.
I think I always like starting at the end and going backwards. But the water transport, I mean, certainly. The moving along rivers was key. And in fact, part of the reason Cahokia is there is because it's right in the middle of the Mississippi, right where the Missouri and the Illinois River kind of meet, or just to the south. And so it's not so much about moving around to trade, which they do, but it is certainly about moving up and down and spreading the, you know, the good word, and getting people to easily move in and out to visit on various kind of ceremonial days. So canoes are found still today, occasionally turning up in bayous and rivers of the South particularly. But, you know, they're dugouts, a lot of them, and that was key. There's also overland transport, by the way. So a lot of the highways that we see today going in and out of St. Louis, you can track some of them back to the French, who then track them back to Native American trails. And so overland transport was certainly also big. Some of those are probably ceremonial avenues for pilgrims coming in and out of Cahokia itself. Now, going back before that, I mean, the economy of this place, besides being based on water transport, is also certainly based on native starchy seeds, so amaranth, chenopodium, maygrass, and other seeds. Those were staples, and they had been staples for hundreds of years in native North America. Cahokians had took those and maximized or intensified their growing of those, and in addition also intensified corn, which had come in a couple centuries before Cahokia, so it was there already. But based on this very traditional subsistence economy, they built Cahokia. Nothing new happened at the beginning of Cahokia to, you know, in terms of agriculture to create it. But it was certainly based on that economy.
I think that does a pretty good job of dealing with the question. We have some other folks. Let's go to Urbana next, and that's line number three. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Last year and in previous years, I think, there were elder hostels offered at Cahokia. They've changed the name now. It's Road Scholar. I was planning to go this year, but I'm not finding any listings for it. Do you happen to know if there will be an elder hostel there this year?
I'm sorry.
I should say Road Scholar.
I do not know.
Do not know.
That's
okay.
Something you'd have to call down to the Interpretive Center and ask them directly. And they list the phone number on their website, so you could find that phone number and give them a call.
I see. Well, it's sounding more interesting all the time. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. We'll go over to Belgium, and this is line number four. Hello.
Hello, and how are you today, gentlemen?
Okay. Fine.
I hope I'm not covering information that you have not already covered, but Dixon Mounds, across the river from Dixon Mounds in Havana, there's another mound situation on the east side of the Illinois. Immediately south of Havana, where there is a large power plant, there was a very large mound there, too. You come over here on the Vermilion and on the Wabash, there are several mound areas, too, that are all definitely associated with rivers and very close to it. I've always wondered if these areas are associated with Cahokia, like outlying areas, communities and stuff?
Some are, but I probably need to be clear that, mound building goes way back in North America. In Louisiana, it goes all the way back to 3500 B.C., in the Midwest, along the Wabash, the Vermilion, or the Illinois, it goes back to the late Archaic period, which is about 1 or 2000 BC. And then you get an efflorescence around the time of Christ, right around zero. And that's that Middle Woodland Hopewell phenomenon that I talked about in Ohio, which also spills, you know, into Indiana and up and through Illinois and Wisconsin and south.
Yeah, they go down through Tennessee and Kentucky.
Yeah, pretty much the whole eastern half of the United States. And so a lot of burial mounds, a lot of geometric earthworks in Ohio and a few other places. And then you get sort of a gap, and it's called the late woodland period, where there's not too much ceremonial activity happening across the eastern United States. And then you get Mississippian, with Cahokia kind of bringing it all back and reinventing it all. Now, Dixon Mounds very definitely is connected to Cahokia. Dixon Mound starts off as some kind of little colony. There's a site right below the hill, if you've ever visited Dixon Mounds, the museum's on top.
I used to live there.
Okay. All right. So you know.
Yeah.
And that there they're finding, and they've going back a few years with excavations, you know, classic Cahokia pottery and some other things brought up by people who moved to that area. There were already people living there, but they moved in alongside these locals and kind of Cahokianized the Illinois Valley. And then there are a series of other sites that follow, and some sort of spectacularly large village sites that end up later in time maybe warring with Cahokia. We're not sure, but they occasionally get burned down. So the history of the Illinois Valley was very much affected by Cahokia, and certainly the Wabash was too, but we know a little less about the whole Wabash Valley.
So then after the Cahokians, shall we call them, subside, then along come the Kickapoo and the Illini and all the other various tribes that are here. Are they actually related to those same folks, or splinter groups, or they come in later, or how does that work?
Relationships are always sticky because a lot of the tribal identities that we see in the historic era or today were historic era phenomena. So it's hard to completely and neatly segregate people based on what we know from the historic era. More than likely, Kickapoo, Illini, and other Algonquian speakers were moving into Illinois from southern Michigan, Indiana, kind of being pushed this way because of the Iroquois, who were very aggressive and warlike and pushing and raided into Illinois. So they're more recent. That doesn't mean that there weren't some Algonquian-speaking ancestors at Cahokia. But they also were probably speaking Siouan and Caddoan languages. We now think Cahokia was something of an amalgam, maybe even a multi-ethnic a place, much like many early cities. So, it's just difficult to – I can't tell you there's one group of descendants. There probably aren't. There's probably many descendants that have filtered into different tribal groups that we know today.
Especially, like you say, the Iroquois pushed a lot of people around, and forced a lot of speakers.
In their day, Cahokians probably pushed some people around. Certainly, they may have carvings and symbolism showing them being aggressive.
I see.
Which is maybe they're missionizing and colonizing. They may also be having a few little military campaigns against people they don't like.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. The answer to this question may be obvious, I don't know, but how do you explain the propensity of people to build essentially artificial hills so they can stand on top of them?
Yeah, that's really – that's got to go back to – I can't answer that. No one can answer that question because it's so broad and global that it's like there's something universal about in the psyche or in the way people cognize their world and the upper and the lower, sky and earth, that somehow doing something in between that somehow links the two, like the Egyptian pyramids do that or Mesoamerican pyramids do that. That seems, a natural propensity of people to do. So it's not just about getting up above and looking down to dominate people. It's about kind of bringing the cosmos together, earth and sky together in some kind of monument. It's universal. I can't explain it.
You talked a little bit about some of the ideas about how it is that Cahokia went into this very dramatic period of growth, thinking about why perhaps that might have happened. And it flourished for a relatively short period of time and then fairly quickly collapsed. Mm. What are some of the ideas that would explain what happened? Why did it start to die out?
It is a little unusual in that most cities, once you build a city in some region of the world, say Mesopotamia or Mesoamerica, there'll be other cities that follow. Cahokia, when it collapses, nothing really follows it. Of course, unfortunately, the Europeans arrive and they sort of like eliminate the possibilities. But it seems like I don't even know if I should call it a collapse, but the deterioration or the ultimate depopulation of that place is a two-step process. 100 years after you get this astounding kind of fluorescence, people start leaving. The support community, the farmers who are living out in the hinterland, we know for sure that some of them leave. We don't know where they're going, but they're not staying around the area. So maybe they're not satisfied with whatever is happening. And that's just 100 years into it. Another 100 years later, that is a total of 200 years after the city is built, even more people are leaving. And there's an attempt at reorganizing in the process. At Cahokia, they kind of build a wall. They introduce some new ceremonies, but it doesn't seem to work. So there's something going on, probably social problems, political problems first. Then what happens around 1250 is major droughts and a cooling of the climate overall. It may be, with fewer farmers around, tougher to grow crops in a way that you could support all the festivities and all the happenings at a city. And it just really breaks down owing to climate change. And there are some other factors, but I think those are reasonable and when people leave, by 1350, there's nobody at Cahokia. I mean, there, well, let's say 1400, there's nobody. So, and more interesting than that, when they leave, and you can try to track them into, you know, the historic era, it's hard to find any references. In fact, there are no references to Cahokia among the likely descendants. It's like they're almost trying to forget it. Like it's an experiment that they don't want to remember. A lot of them stop building mounds. They move into totally new environments. It may be a very intentional forgetting process.
That's such a fascinating thing, because you would have to think if the reason the place grew so rapidly and flourished was because people had this idea that the folks there knew something really important. They had possession of some really significant truth that explained life, the universe, and everything. You know, what could have come along to suddenly have people start thinking, now, wait a minute, do these people really have the big truth?
Well, if the basis of your social, of your society is religion, I mean, too much religion can be a bad thing. If it's not built on something else, and so there's some events that undercut people's beliefs, that could throw the whole thing into turmoil, and people say, forget it. You know, I don't believe that anymore. I'm going somewhere else where I can believe in whatever they're offering. So I think religion is clearly very important in coming together, and it might ultimately be sort of the undoing of the place.
Our guest is Timothy Pocketet. He's a professor of anthropology at University of Illinois. We're talking about Cahokia, a place where he's done a lot of archaeological work. He's also author of the book Cahokia, Ancient America's Great City on the Mississippi. It's published by Penguin. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus, and we have some other callers, and we'll talk with them. Next, we have someone in Spring Bay. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hopi mythology talks about from Second Mesa, the Hopi migrating in four directions, and I'm just wondering if Cahokia and these mound builders would have any connection to Hopi mythology of cultures or civilizations moving out into this area, and I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
No direct connection. The Hopi are in no way really related to, through blood anyway, related to the people of Cahokia. There are various groups in the Eastern Plains and in the South who have direct blood connections to Cahokia. They also have migration stories, as it turns out. So like the Hopi, people do remember, where they moved from and, why. At least they have stories about why. Not so much in the case of Cahokia, more so in the case of the Puebloan folks out in the Southwest, the Hopi included. And there, in fact, the Hopi probably, among other Puebloan speakers, did come from Chaco Canyon. And they remember Chaco Canyon. At least they have some stories that you read and you think, or you listen to and you think, that is Chaco. So they didn't intentionally forget as much as the Cahokians seem to have done. I don't know if that answers the question completely, but...
Let me ask you a slightly different question. Were there connections between people at Cahokia and then people who had large population centers further south, Mexico, Central America?
Well, even to the Southwest, there are connections. There are historical links. You can look at certain pottery attributes of Mississippians, people living in the Mississippi Valley, and they look like the Southwest, certain stepped motifs. You can do the same thing and say those look Mesoamerican. The link with Mesoamerica is even stronger, in fact. Now, there is no direct sort of smoking gun evidence of a Mesoamerican having come up and visited and leaving behind his or her things. But what there are interesting symbols or personal ornaments that didn't exist before 1050, before Cahokia, that did right after 1050, ear ornaments, hero imagery, that look Mesoamerican. So it's a good bet that Cahokians, as part of their outreach program in the middle 11th century, know about Mesoamerica and maybe even go down and learn and get some knowledge and come back. And that's the kind of link, the historical link. Probably not, they're not actual Mesoamericans.
Yeah. No. I find fascinating the idea that people would have traveled very long distances to visit with, get to know people in other places.
I think back then people had a much different sense of space and distance and travel. You would travel for long periods all around the world, Europe too. I mean, great pilgrimages were made. Christians, non-Christians, Islamic, American Indians. And going back to 2,000 years ago, you can see that people from Ohio went up into Wyoming and then came back. That's 2,000 miles or so, I believe. So a 2,000-mile trip is not inconceivable, and that's about the distance from Cahokia to Mesoamerica. Mm. You can hop a canoe part of the way, and then get off another river and then walk inland.
Let's take some other calls. Fisher next, line one. Hello?
Yes, I wonder if you could go over the history of worked stone implements just briefly, where the stone came from and the trade involved, and I'll get off and listen.
Okay.
Well, if you're asking specifically about Cahokian stone industries, then you're looking mostly at people who know all of the stone sources in the greater St. Louis area, especially the Ozarks, but in the interior of the Shawnee Hills in southern Illinois as well. I mean, they're hoe blades, which are these sort of sharp ends like a garden hoe. They would attach to a long stick. Were coming from Union County, Illinois. Some of their adze blades, tools made to shape wood, were also coming from that area. Similar kind of tools were being chipped out of material from South St. Louis in Jefferson County, Missouri, the Ozarks, the northern Ozarks. Axe heads, which are impressive kind of groundstone tools that, they would have fitted into handles, are being made out of rock from around Ironton, Missouri, deep into the Ozarks. So it's mostly local. They do get exotic goods, marine shell or copper from way off, mica from North Carolina and copper from Lake Superior and marine shell, obviously, from the Gulf. But that's not really their everyday tools. Those are mostly coming from the local area.
And these people, were they a metalworking culture?
Well, they worked copper. They worked copper. They hammered copper. There's some thought more recently by earlier people might have actually, heated it up and actually almost smelted it. But so far it looks like the copper is just for ornaments and they're hammering it cold. And that's it. There's not that much in the way of native ores around. There's iron ore and they do use it, but they don't do much with it. They use it mostly for pigment.
Hmm. All right. To Urbana, line number two. Hello.
My question isn't directly pertinent, I suppose, but when the Spanish crossed the southern part of the United North America in the early 1500s, they reported that in crossing Louisiana and Arkansas, the area was heavily populated, that you could stand on a high point in any village and see other villages at the horizon. But yes. When the French came through 100 years later, there was no population at all in that area. Has any archaeological research been done on this question?
Quite a bit. Depending on where one is in the South, there have been some intensive studies that show that up to 90% of the population is erased. They die because of the diseases that DeSoto and other later folks bring in. Now there's less catastrophic death in other parts of the Southeast, but it depends where you are and how closely people rubbed elbows with Europeans coming through. And there are major studies that show this, especially along the southern lower Mississippi Valley, the people that you're talking about, in fact.
I suppose the extinction of the native people by this epidemic in the 1500s and 1600s and later, that has decimated the folk traditions that would give us a lot of enlightenment about what's going on in Cahokia, too, wouldn't it?
You're exactly right. Unlike the gentleman earlier talked about the Hopi and the stories that they still tell, the problem in the East is that, right, the priests, the people who would remember, only comprise, you know, a few percent of any population. And if they happened to get sick and they died, there went the knowledge for that group. And that happened probably repeatedly in the South and in the Midwest. So there's been a lot that's been lost and forgotten. Yes, that was a sad chapter of American history.
One hates to think of what would have happened. Most of these were animal diseases that had infected the Europeans. If the North American Indians had had domesticated animals and had complementary diseases for the Europeans to carry back to Europe in the 1500s.
I mean, syphilis, for instance.
Syphilis is the main one, yeah. And it was devastating enough.
Yeah, and you could also, of course, you know, tobacco, all the problems around tobacco, you could sort of project backwards in the same way.
But if 90% of the population of Europe had died off,
right,
civilization wouldn't be where it is today.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the farming practices at Cahokia, from what I've read, were strikingly different from some of those of the rest of the eastern United States. The Indians apparently had planted large groves of native fruit trees and nut trees, and these were an important part of their food supply. And certainly they practiced growing a number of plants other than corn. Amaranth, I think they had a variety of chickweed that had a very large seed and which is apparently extinct now. This may have been a much more sustainable agriculture than the corn-based agriculture at Cahokia.
Well, that is true that they didn't rely on corn so much that it was had deleterious effects on their health. And later people did, later Mississippians, you know, that the Spanish and kind of were eating a lot of corn, and that's not really good for you. So it was slightly different. The same series of crops are really, and fruit trees and other kind of fruits and tubers and whatnot are pretty widely used across the eastern woodlands, but to the difference of degree, I guess, yes.
I need to chime in here. We just have about 5 minutes with our guest, Tim Pocketot. He's a professor of anthropology here at University of Illinois, and we're talking about Cahokia. One thing that I'd like to have you talk some about is the challenge as an archaeologist investigating a place where, first of all, there's no written record. So you just have to go with what's there on the ground, in the ground, what you can find to then think about trying to figure out how people lived, you know, what their daily activities were like, what their agriculture was like, what they ate, what they did on special days, what their religion might have been. And talk about how it is that you work with what it is that you can find to try to, you know, make a story of what life in Cahokia was like.
I tell my historic archaeologist colleagues that we're better off not having written records. Because if you have written records, you're fooled into thinking that you know more than you do. Because, you know, only a few people ever write even today, so that they talk about what other people are doing. Well, they may be wrong. They may even be lying in some cases. So I think not having written records is good because it forces us to look for those mundane, everyday, kind of what are people doing here? What are they doing over there? You know, how are they relating to each other? And the challenge is that requires a very intensive kind of archaeology where you not only have to dig just one house of a farmer in some village, you've got to dig houses of lots of villages to see the diversity. I mean, there was great diversity in the past. They didn't do all things alike, even around Cahokia. And part of, you know, knowing that is part of the story of here's how it happened. You know, it's a diverse group of people coming together. But just to get that point, we've had to dig scores and scores, maybe even hundreds of villages and farmsteads in that part of the country. And the challenge then becomes, what do you do with all the stuff and once you've excavated it? And so it's a curation problem as well as just a logistical, costly process of extracting things from the ground. A lot of this is forced onto us. We know a lot about Cahokia because there's so much modern development. So many archaeologists in the past and in the present have just tried to keep up with saving things before it gets blitzed. So on the one hand, we have no option. This is the way we have to do archaeology in that region. On the other hand, it is good. I mean, we can tell pretty interesting, detailed historical stories.
Yeah. Well, I think people will have taken their introductory anthropology courses and think back to when it was they were first learning about what archaeologists do and how you approach a site. And the idea is that the ideal is that you'd be able to do this with some care.
Yeah,
take your time, very carefully chart out what's there, how things are in relation to each other.
That's the way we do it.
But it sounds like you can't always do it like
well,
that.
Well, you do it that way, but you don't want to do it so much that you're basically wasting time and letting other things get destroyed. Hmm. So it's sometimes a kind of a salvage or a kind of a crazy kind of push. So we got to get this done. We got to get this out. You do it exactly how you said. We control for all where everything is coming vertically and horizontally, from different proveniences. But you do it enough and you get good at that, and that doesn't slow it down as much. And we have special ways of extracting certain kinds of perishables and sensitive samples that we can do it pretty fast and move on. It's a necessity. The image of just sitting in a hole and taking your time and working on it for 20 years, that doesn't happen in the Midwest.
Just to finish up, we talked at the beginning about the fact that Cahokia is a World Heritage Site, but it's not a national monument.
Right.
Is there some effort, you think, that might get us that point?
There's a lobbying effort that's gaining steam. I'm involved with it. There are other people in the state and in other states, both Native and archaeologists, Native activists and archaeologists and other concerned citizens. So that is – we're pushing a couple of things ahead. The book that you – I'm using that book that we just published to help try to promote this notion. And there's some resistance in some quarters, but, the people who work there actually are very much – want to do this too because they see it as a step that will help preserve more and promote it the way it should be promoted.
So it's how far is it here from – how long would it take to drive from here to Cahokia?
If you obey the speed laws, it's not quite 3 hours, 2.5 to 3 hours.
So it's an easy drive from here.
It's an easy drive.
And it's a place that people should see. And I'm sure they have a website if you want to find out more about it.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
And maybe if people want to look at the current issue of National Geographic, there's also an article in
there.
Right. And you can also look at Timothy Pocketat's book, Cahokia, Ancient America's Great City on the Mississippi. It's published by Penguin Books. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, thank you.
And you're listening to a program. You have been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. We first broadcast the show on January the 19th. This show, other past shows from Focus, a lot of our local product here is available on our website, and you can listen anytime that you're ready. If you haven't looked at it, you should check it out. It's will.illinois.edu. And coming up in the next show, we'll also have an archive, again, one from January, dealing with the controversial subject of animal rights. So that's our number two. First, though, we'll take a break, as we usually do at this point, so we can bring you an update on the markets and some news from NPR. So stay tuned.
Today's programs are made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign. For over 25 years, 10,000 Villages has provided income to artisans in more than 30 developing countries by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
At a minute before 11 o'clock with this market update, I'm Tom Rogers. The board is showing a lot of red this morning in Chicago and in Kansas City. May wheat in Kansas City is down 3.25 cents at the moment at 8.38¾. July down 3 at 8.49¾. May Chicago wheat is down 6.25 cents a bushel at 7.14¾. The July off 5¾ at 7.51¼. May corn is at 6.79 and a quarter right now, down 7.25 cents. July down 6.5 at 6.87. September corn 6.41, down 4.5. Crude oil right now up $1.02 a barrel at 103.35 for the April contract. In the bean complex, May soybeans down 6 at 13.57 a bushel. July at 13.66 and a quarter, down 6.75. August down 6 at 13.63 and a half. September 13.50, down 7.5 cents. Soybean meal for May is down 2 even at 364.60. Soybean oil is at 55.57, down 31. April live cattle are up 7.5 cents a hundredweight at 113.67 and a half. April